Essays on the Improvement of the Mind by Hester Mulso Chapone, Letter 1. My dearest niece, though you are so happy as to have parents who are both capable and desirous of giving you all proper instruction, yet I, who love you so tenderly, cannot help fondly wishing to contribute something, if possible, to your improvement and welfare. And as I am so far separated from you that it is only by pen and ink I can offer you my sentiments, I will hope that your attention may be engaged by seeing on paper, from the hand of one of your warmest friends, truths of the highest importance, which, though you may not find new, can never be too deeply engraven in your mind. Some of them, perhaps, may make no great impression at present, and yet may so far gain a place in your memory as readily to return to your thoughts when occasion recalls them. And if you pay me the compliment of preserving my letters, you may possibly re-peruse them at some future period when concurring circumstances may give them additional weight. And thus, they may prove more effectual than the same things spoken in conversation. But however this may prove, I cannot resist the desire of trying to be in some degree useful to you on your setting out in a life of trial and difficulty, your success in which must determine your fate forever.
Hello and welcome to the WPHP Monthly Mercury, the podcast for the Women's Print History Project. The WPHP is a bibliographic database that collects information about women and book production during the 18th and 19th centuries. My name is Kate Moffat.
And I'm Candace Sharon.
And we are longtime editors of the WPHP and the hosts of this podcast. On the third Wednesday of every month, we'll introduce you to anecdotes, puzzles, and problems related to recovering evidence of women's involvement in print. It's September. Already, we can't believe it. And September means back to school. With the various forms education is taking this year, we were reminded of the wide range of educational works in the WPHP, which include everything from grammar books and dictionaries to addresses to young ladies, and the important role of education literature in women's print history during the Romantic period. In this month's episode of the WPHP Monthly Mercury, we are going to take a little gander through the education literature of the WPHP to explore the diversity of the genres related to education and its various formats, and to take a little peek at the role of the genre field in the database. We also speak to one of our past research assistants, Rhys Irwin, about the process of entering children's literature into the database, a task unto itself. We'll be sharing a couple of short readings from a selection of educational works, including an excerpt from Mary Wollstonecraft's Thoughts on the Education of Daughters and Hannah Moore's delightfully titled Sinful Sally to illustrate the wide variety of formats, styles, and content. And because we just couldn't resist, they're variably dramatic, serious, hilarious, and fun.
As the reading from Hester Mulso Chapone's Letters on the Improvement of the Mind that opens this episode suggests, education had high stakes. For middle and upper class young women in the period we focus on, education was often slapdash. There was no curriculum, standardized testing, or opportunity for formal education, and it was often overseen by their parents at home. Those schools for girls that did exist often focused on accomplishments over intellectual development, something that many women writers from different political and religious affiliations in the period decried. Likewise, while many boys of the same classes did attend school, much of their early education would take place in the home, also overseen by their mothers. On the one hand, this approach to education often reinforced barriers related to class and wealth. As we saw this spring, when many schools shifted to remote learning because of COVID-19, families with more resources had access to a wider array of options for educating their children. On the other hand, the frequently informal nature of 18th and 19th century education provided women of the middle and upper classes with the opportunity to claim a unique kind of cultural authority. Because mothers were entrusted with educating the next generation, they were able to stake a claim for women's education as an issue of national importance. As a result, writing about education, as well as writing for children, often gestures towards political and philosophical debates of the period. As we're going to look at today, it also took a number of different forms, from didactic writing aimed at children and adolescents of all ages, to radical political tracts like Mary Wollstonecraft's Vindication of the Rights of Woman, to books aimed at parents about how to educate their children.
With such a variety of forms, it's unsurprising that assigning a genre to an educational work in the WPHP is actually really complicated. Genre can be a particularly fraught element of data entry across the board. It is, perhaps more than any other field in the WPHP, subjective, and education texts often fit within multiple genres. We have 29 genres that we use in the WPHP. We'll include a link to the full genre list, which includes working definitions, in our blog post for this episode. But as a rule, we assign title records with whatever genre the work declares itself as in its title. Novels will occasionally declare themselves a novel in their full titles, for example, making that a very easy assignment, and often so do romances, tales, and stories. Assigning broader genres, however, such as education, religion, and political writing, can be a more subjective process, particularly when texts serve or speak to a multitude of purposes or audiences. We have occasionally, for example, assigned genre based on research. Our RA Sarah Penn mentioned in our last episode that we have Mary Prince's slave narrative in the database as political writing, a genre choice made to reflect the scholarship of James Olney. Our data model attaches only one genre to each title record, but as Candace has just pointed out, many of these works could reasonably fit within multiple. Books relating to education could fall under education, but they could also just as easily fit into juvenile literature, domestic, religion, spiritual, or essays, depending on their scope, approach, and intended audience. Some even count as novels. The wide variety of genres that could be attached to these texts makes an important point that educational literature took many formats and that it was directed to a number of audiences. We're going to address some of the various forms that fall under the education umbrella and use a couple of terrifically fun excerpts to demonstrate the genre's variety. Hester Mulso Chapone's letter, which we read at the beginning of this episode, is indicative of one format, which was letters to female relations. But letters were a popular format more generally. They found their way into various educational works and topics, and this is also, of course, yet another potential genre for this work, letters. We do, however, tend to use the letters genre in the WPHP for published compilations of actual letters, such as those of Ignatius Sancho, discussed in a few of our previous episodes, or collections of letters that don't easily fit into other categories, but we don't typically include fictional letters. The letters format lends itself to a number of uses. It's a flexible form, and we can see it in a couple of other titles in the WPHP that fall into the education genre, or those close to it. This includes Jane West's Letters to a Young Lady, which is under the education genre, Emily Taylor's Letters to a Child on the Subject of Maritime Discovery, which we have in the juvenile literature genre. We also have Mariah Edgeworth's Letters for Literary Ladies, which is in the essays genre, and Clara Reeve's Plans for Education with Remarks on the Systems of Other Writers in a Series of Letters Between Mrs. Darnford and Her Friends, which is in the education genre as well.
Another possible format was something like Mary Wollstonecraft's Thoughts on the Education of Daughters, which is essay-like in structure and instructional to both parents and daughters. This work was based on Wollstonecraft's own experience working as a governess and running a school with her sisters and their close friend, Fanny Blood, which closed shortly before she chose to publish these letters. During this period, working as an educator, especially as a governess, was exhausting and not particularly well-paid work, and the women who undertook it often occupied an uncomfortable middle space between the wealthy family that employed them and the lower-class servants in the household. If you've ever read Jane Eyre, Jane Eyre's position is a perfect example of kind of the trials of a governess in this period. So in an attempt to support herself and her family doing work other than teaching, Wollstonecraft turned to writing. Thoughts on the Education of Daughters was published by Joseph Johnson in 1786, and its full title, Thoughts on the Education of Daughters with Reflections on Female Conduct in the More Important Duties of Life, is indicative of its contents. It is in many ways a conduct manual, which is a work essentially for young women in the 18th century that tells them how to behave in different social situations. But it also starts to lay the groundwork for the proto-feminist arguments that Wollstonecraft would make a few years later in Vindication of the Rights of Woman. In her later and more overtly political and radical works, Wollstonecraft picks up the thread of this discussion to argue that women's education is essential for creating a rational and a more just society, not just because women should be educated for their own sakes, but because they will pass their own education on to a subsequent generation. However, Thoughts on the Education of Daughters focuses more on the practical element of education rather than its philosophical underpinnings. So this work includes advice on how to approach love, marriage, and accomplishments. The reading we've chosen from it is a selection from the exterior accomplishments section.
Thoughts on the Education of Daughters, with Reflections on Female Conduct in the More Important Duties of Life by Mary Wollstonecraft. Exterior accomplishments. Under this head may be ranked all those accomplishments which merely render the person attractive, and those half-learnt ones which do not improve the mind. A little learning of any kind is a dangerous thing, and so far from making a person pleasing, it has the contrary effect. Parents have mostly some weighty, weighty business in hand, which they make a pretext to themselves for neglecting the arduous task of educating their children. They are therefore sent to school, and the allowance for them is so low that the person who undertakes the charge must have more than she can possibly attend to. Of course, the mechanical parts of education can only be observed. I have known children who could repeat things in the order they learnt them, that were quite at a loss when put out of the beaten track. If the understanding is not exercised, the memory will be employed to little purpose. Girls learn something of music, drawing, and geography, but they do not know enough to engage their attention, and render it an employment of the mind. If they can play over a few tunes to their acquaintance, and have a drawing or two, half done by the master, to hang up in their rooms, they imagine themselves artists for the rest of their lives. It is not the being able to execute a trifling landscape or anything of the kind that is of consequence. These are at best but trifles, and the foolish, indiscriminate praises which are bestowed on them only produce vanity. But what is really of no importance when considered in this light becomes of the utmost when a girl has a fondness for the art and a desire of excellence. Whatever tends to make a person in some measure independent of the sense is a prop to virtue. Amusing employments must first occupy the mind, and as an attention to moral duties leads to piety, so whoever weighs one subject will turn to others, and new ideas will rush into the mind. The faculties will be exercised and not suffered to sleep, which will give a variety to the character.
While Mary Wollstonecraft became a major radical thinker in the 1790s, her thoughts about female education informed her arguments in Vindication of the Rights of Woman, among other texts. Similar arguments about the importance of women's education and the role of women in society were also made by female writers on the opposite end of the political spectrum, which is something that Harriet Guest explores in her book Small Change. Hannah More was a deeply conservative writer who, in addition to plays, poetry, and one of the best-selling novels of the early 1800s, wrote educational essays addressed explicitly to or for the improvement of young women. For example, essays on various subjects principally designed for young ladies. However, her educational project was not just aimed at middle and upper class women. She also wrote works, usually religious in their emphasis, for the lower classes, and many of these were printed in a series called the Cheap Repository Tracts, which were short, usually somewhere around 16 to 32 page pamphlets that were priced cheaply, which meant they could be widely distributed. And this also means, as I believe I reference in my RA interview on the WPHP site, that they are a pain to find and date and add to the database because there were so many different editions with small differences. During her lifetime, Hannah More became one of the most influential women writers in England, in large part because of the success and wide distribution of her Cheap Repository Tracts, which aimed to inculcate Christian values in the lower classes. These works generally tended to focus on obedience and acceptance of the status quo, rather than teaching people to question social structures. And Anne Stott has described her strategies as unashamed social engineering. In this case, she's referring to Moore's involvement in the charity schools that she promoted in order to help educate lower class women. But her writing for the poor, I think, also fits this category. This is why, interestingly, even though her writing is heavily didactic, it is also often enjoyable, as is the case with her poem Sinful Sally, which was published, again, as one of the cheap repository tracts. So the full title of Sinful Sally is, like Wollstonecraft's thoughts, indicative of its contents, and it points specifically towards one of Moore's most significant concerns, the desire to manage women's sexuality. So the full title of this poem is The Story of Sinful Sally Told by Herself, showing how from being Sally of the Green, she was first led to become Sinful Sally, and afterwards Drunken Sal, and how at last she came to a most melancholy and almost hopeless end, being therein a warning to all young women, both in town and country. It's as melodramatic as it sounds, and we're going to read it to you in its entirety because we couldn't bear to choose just a selection. Come each maiden, lend an ear, country lass and London belle, come and drop a mournful tear o'er the tale that I shall tell. I that ask your tender pity, ruined now and all forlorn, once, like you, was young and pretty, and as cheerful as the morn. In yon distant cottage sitting, far away from London town, once you might have seen me knitting in my simple kersey gown.
Where the little lambkins leap, where the meadow looks so gay, where the drooping willows weep, Simple Sally used to stray. Then I tasted many a blessing, then I had an honest fame. Father, mother, me caressing, smiled and thought me free from blame. Then, amid my friends so dear, life it speeded fast away. Oh, it moves a tender tear to bethink me of the day.
From the villages surrounding, ere I well had reached 18, came the modest youths abounding, all to Sally of the Green. Courting days were thus beginning, and I soon had proved a wife. Oh, if I had kept from sinning, now how blessed had been my life. Come each maiden, lend an ear, country lass and London belle, come ye now and deign to hear how poor Sinful Sally fell.
Where the hill begins inclining, half a furlong from the road, o'er the village white and shining, stands Sir William's great abode. Near his meadow I was tripping, vainly wishing to be seen, when Sir William met me skipping, and he spoke me on the green. Bid me quit my cloak of scarlet, blamed my simple kersey gown, eyed me then so like a varlet, such as live in London town.
With his presence I was loaded, and bedecked in ribbons gay, thus my ruin was foreboded. Oh, how crafty was his way! Vanished now from cottage lowly, my poor parents' hearts I break, enter on a state unholy, turn a mistress to a rake. Now no more by morning light up to God my voice I raise, now no shadows of the night call my thoughts to prayer and praise.
Hark, a well-known sound I hear, 'tis the church's Sunday bell. No, I dread to venture near, no, I am now the child of hell. Now I lay my Bible by, choose that impious book so new, love the bold blaspheming lie, and that filthy novel too. Next to London town I pass, Sinful Sally is my name, there to gain a front of brass, and to glory in my shame.
Powdered well and puffed and painted, rivals all I there outshine, with my skin so white and heart so tainted, rolling in my chariot fine. In the park I glitter daily, then I dress me for the play, then to masquerade so gaily, see me tear away. When I meet some meaner lass, then I toss with proud disdain, laugh and giggle as I pass, seeming not to know a pain.
Still, at every hour of leisure, something whispers me within, oh, I hate this life of pleasure, for it is a life of sin. Thus, amidst my peals of laughter, horror seizes oft my frame. Pleasure now, damnation after, and a never-dying flame. Save me, save me, Lord, I cry. Save my soul from Satan's chain. Now I see salvation nigh. Now I turn to sin again.
Is it then some true repentance that I feel for evil done? No, 'tis horror of my sentence. 'Tis the pangs of hell begun. But a thousand ills o'ertaken see me now quite sinking down, till so lost and so forsaken, Sal is cast upon the town. At the dusk of evening gray, forth I step from secret cell, roaming like a beast of prey, or some hateful imp from hell.
Ah, how many youths so blooming by my wanton looks I've won, then by vices all-consuming left them ruined and undone. This the cruel spider stretches wide his web for every fly. Then each victim that he catches straight he poisons till he die. Now no more by conscience troubles deep I plunge in every sin. True, my sorrows are redoubled, but I drown them all in gin.
See me next with front so daring, band of ruffian rogues among, fighting, cheating, drinking, swearing, and the vilest of the throng. Mark the youngest of the thieves. Taught by Sal, he ventures further. What he filches, Sal receives. 'Tis for Sal he does the murder. See me then attend my victim to the fatal gallows tree. Pleased to think how I have nicked him, made him swing while I am free.
Jack I laughing see depart, while with Dick I drink and sing. Soon again I'll fill the cart, make this present lover swing. But while thus with guilt surprising Sal pursues her bold career, see God's dreadful wrath arising and the day of vengeance near. Fierce disease my body seizes, racking pain afflicts my bones, dread of death my spirit freezes, deep and doleful are my groans.
Here with face so shrunk and spotted, on the clay-cold ground I lie, see how all my flesh is rotted, stop. O stranger, see me die. Conscience, as my breath's departing, plunges too his arrow deep, with redoubled fury starting, like some giant from his sleep. In this pit of ruin lying, once again before I die, fainting, trembling, weeping, sighing, Lord, to thee I'll lift mine eye.
Thou canst save the vilest harlot. Grace, I've heard, is free and full. Sins that once were red as scarlet, thou canst make as white as wool. Savior, whom I've pierced so often, deeper still my guilt imprint. Let thy mighty spirit soften this my hardened heart of flint. Vain, alas, is all my groaning, for I fear the die is cast. True, thy blood is all atoning, but my day of grace is past.
Savior, hear me or I perish. None who lives is quite undone. Still, a ray of hope I'll cherish till eternity's begun.
Sinful Sally is clearly a marvelous read. We had such a fantastic time reading it. But its form of publication indicates an important point about how the intended audience of a work can not only impact its content, but also shape its production and dissemination. Its message was, as Candace said, directed towards young women of the lower classes. Its contents, which include murder and drama and seductions, hook the reader while also offering a moral. Do not give in to vice. And do not allow yourself to be seduced by the Lord who lives down the road. Its publication format, however, cheap repository tracts, made the work accessible to those without the resources to spend on books, which were, during this period, prohibitively expensive and far beyond the means of anyone below the upper classes. Cheap repository tracts were so cheap that they were often purchased in bulk by persons or institutions, such as the church, that wanted to distribute them to a particular group. It's worth noting, however, that cheap repository tracts such as Sinful Sally were also republished in more expensive forms as well, suggesting their popularity went beyond the intended audience of the lower classes.
Book production was also an increasingly important element of books directed at children, a market that exploded in our period. This market includes books for very young children. So Anna Letitia Barbauld's Lessons for Children of 3 Years Old is one of those. And it begins with a preface that notes how the design of the book itself should match its function and its audience. She writes that books for children must use good paper, a clear and large type, and large spaces, because the eyes of a child and of a learner cannot catch, as ours can, a small, obscure, ill-formed word amidst a number of others all equally unknown to him. So Lessons for Children of 3 years Old is very clearly meant to meet these specifications and to be read to and with a young child. And this is signaled both by the language of the book, its contents, and its design. The first story, as you'll hear in a moment, is both educational and playful, clearly designed to be narrated to a child. And looking at the publication also shows that the letters are large and there's plenty of white space on the page. So not only is it meant to be read to a child, but also potentially read by a child. Please enjoy Kate reading to a fictional 3-year-old Charles with much gusto.
Charles, what a clever thing it is to read. A little while ago, you know, you could only read little words, and you were forced to spell them. C-A-T, cat. D-O-G, dog. Now you can read pretty stories, and I am going to write you some. Do you know why you are better than Puss? Puss can play as well as you, and Puss can drink milk and lie upon the carpet, and she can run as fast as you, and faster too, a great deal. And she can climb trees better, and she can catch mice, which you cannot do. But can Puss talk? No. Can Puss read? No. Then that is the reason why you are better than Puss, because you can talk and read. Can Pierrot, your dog, read? No. Will you teach him? Take the pin and point to the words. No, he will not learn. I never saw a little dog or cat learn to read, but little boys can learn. If you do not learn, Charles, you are not good for half as much as a Puss. You had better be drowned.
Reading to and with children is a fun and interactive teaching activity. The next work we're going to look at by Charlotte Smith similarly suggests a form of interactive learning in the form of a dialogue. So dialogues are another format that often gets used in educational texts. They synthesize writing aimed at children and writing aimed at educators together in one work. So Charlotte Smith's Rural Walks, for example, offers a model for how learning can be an active process in which the educator speaks to the children being educated, but always in response to the children's questions about the world. This represents a particularly capital R romantic understanding of the self and education, in which learning is experiential and rooted in going out into the world and encountering new situations and people who raise larger questions. This is something that's also in this work linked to the natural world. So here we see the scene of education as something rural, linked to both nature and the agricultural landscape, which is so important to many other romantic writers, such as, for example, William Wordsworth. Charlotte Smith, who had suffered at the hands of a profligate husband, was well acquainted with the consequences of an insufficient education on the lives of men, and her opinions about the education of boys as well as girls are on full display in the following and rather depressing excerpt.
Who is it, Mama?
It is Mr. Somerville, my dear, of whom you have often heard me speak. I think you were once with me when he dined at Brightwell House with a large party. He is a man who possesses a princely fortune and whose whole life passes in a series of generous and obliging actions. His neighbors almost adore him. There's not a peasant within 10 miles of him who would not, to use their own rustic phrase, go through fire and water to serve him by night or by day. Though he lives in splendor proportioned to his fortune, it is without ostentation and without extravagance, and never yet did he see anguish impressed on the countenance even of a common acquaintance, without attempting to relieve it. Is a farmer distressed by bad seasons or accidental losses? Mr. Somerville will assist him with his purse or his credit. Is a laborer sinking under sickness and poverty? It is by Mr. Somerville he has ordered medical advice, and from his kitchen, comfortable nourishment. And all this, and much more, is without ostentation. He thinks that it is so far from being a matter of boast that he merely does his duty.
Oh, Mama, what an happy woman his wife must be.
Alas, my dear Elizabeth, he has no wife. She's been dead many years and left him 2 sons and a daughter.
They must be happy then, Mama.
I wish they were, my love, for the sake of their excellent father, but it is, unfortunately, quite otherwise.
Yet I have often heard, Aunt, that good parents make good children, and of course happy ones.
It is a melancholy reflection that this rule is by no means without exception. The eldest of Mr. Somerville's sons learned very early that he was heir to a very great fortune. At school, he was idle, dissipated, and expensive. These vices gathered strength at college. He spent so much money there that, notwithstanding his father's liberal allowance, he left it some thousands in debt at a very early age, not being able to bear even the little restraint that merely belonging to a society laid upon his actions. His father, not knowing what to do with him, consented to his going abroad when he made exactly the sort of tour described by Lord Chesterfield and returned what is now called a fine man about town. He plays very deep, runs into 1,000 absurd excesses, and seldom or never sees his father, with whom he has no ideas in common, and who cannot help reflecting with regret that his fortune will fall into the hands of a man who will disgrace his name.
But his other son
turns out equally unworthy such a father. This young man, who was educated at home in consequence of the ill success of a public education with his elder brother, most unhappily took, by the neglect of his tutor, a turn for low company. He was unhappy and under visible restraint when he was not either in the stable or in the servants' hall. In the hope of breaking through these habits, his father sent him to Geneva, but they were already become inveterate. He married there an Englishwoman whose obscure birth his father would have overlooked if she had been a person of good character. As it was, this generous and tender parent forgave him, and on his return to England gave him a very handsome establishment. But his wife was so bad an economist, so extravagant and so dissipated, that he soon became embarrassed. Mutual reproaches and recriminations ensued. They quarreled and parted. Thus, deprived of all the prospect of future comfort in regard to his sons, Mr. Somerville turned towards his daughter as his sole consolation. Alas! The promise of happiness with which she had 3 years before been married was already blighted. Her husband, a man of fashion, who at the beginning of their union appeared to be extremely attached to her, had no longer any affection for her, nor did he take the trouble to wear even its semblance. His family, of which he was the only male heir, were displeased that she had brought him no children, and treated her with coldness and neglect. She lost her health, and now passes almost all her time with her father, who endeavors, by tenderness and attention, to heal the wounds of a broken heart, which are, I fear, slowly but certainly condemning her to an early grave.
Excerpts demonstrate, writing related to education was diverse and could take a number of different formats. There were even educational games. Children's literature and educational literature have some unique challenges, however, when it comes to bibliography and entering these works into the database. Candace interviewed Rhys Irwin for this episode, one of our past research assistants who worked on the project from 2016 until 2019 and almost single-handedly entered the majority of our juvenile literature into the database. She is the author of the forthcoming book chapter, Elizabeth Newberry, Publisher and Bookseller in Her Own Right, a case study from the Women's Print History Project, which will be published in Volume 1 of Women in Print, edited by Rose Roberto and Helen S. Williams. She has a master's in English from Simon Fraser University and has recently completed a master's of Library Information Science at the University of British Columbia.
When you joined the WPHP, your first job was entering a lot of the children's literature that we now have in the database. Do you want to describe that process and tell us a bit about what kinds of resources you used?
Yeah, I definitely can. Actually, when I began on this project, I never dreamed I would be the one working through children's literature. Because anyone who knows me, they know I prefer Austen novels and similar giant tomes to picture books. However, after this entire process and going through a few thousand records of children's literature in the database, it's given me this new kind of nerdy passion, if you will. It got to the point where there was a brand new children's picture book about the father of children's literature, publisher John Newbery, came to me at the bookstore I worked at, and I had to buy it 3 years ago. So I went from one end to the other. But yeah, so kind of to describe how I got from just like my toe in the water, knowing nothing about this, to being entirely submerged, I have to start back in 2016. In truth, the summer of 2016, it was a bit of a blur of learning how to enter titles into the database and thinking about entering grad school in the fall. So I was a little bit preoccupied, but I'm going to try and recount the best of my ability. So you actually showed me how to enter titles into the database and how to conduct a data merge, which was taking data from one online source and overseeing the process of entering it into the WPHP. This merge was kind of my first pass at entering children's literature in a systematic way. And I remember entering about 1,400 titles during this process, though a couple might have been thrown out because they were no good. The books, as I'm sure people listening know, they had to have a woman's involvement in some way. So this initial data came from the Osborne Collection of Early Children's Books, a catalog from the Toronto Public Library featuring more than actually 80,000 children's titles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I read that today. I was like, holy crap. Once I had entered these titles, I worked my way through print bibliographies to kind of check the data that had been entered. So I used the Dartons, which was a bibliography of children's book publishers Samuel Harvey, William Darton, and William Darton Sr., book called John Newbery and His Successors, a bibliography of the publisher known as the father of children's lit I mentioned before, and his relations who succeeded him, and John Harris's Books for Youth, a short bibliography focused on publisher John Harris, who was a successor of a successor of John Newbery, which I'll dive into in a minute, as there's a person I'm deliberately not naming here in the lineage.
So a lot of those print bibliographies were publisher specific rather than sort of general children's literature. Do you have any idea why that might be?
I think one of the reasons is children's literature is actually very hard to find. Mm-hmm. It's kind of ephemeral, its nature. It's not really considered super scholarly. So people have tended to focus on the publishers themselves because there's more like evidence that they were there and that they were mm-hmm. doing work. And some of the actual bibliographic entries are a little bit like, well, we have this one record because the publisher wrote a letter to the author, but we don't actually have a copy of the book. So mm-hmm. it could have been published. It might have been published. It was advertised in this catalog, so it likely was published. But just due to the nature of children's literature, it was very hard to kind of take that book approach, I think. So having to do it through publishers was, I think, the kind of the best way in.
Yeah, so it has to do with like publishers' records surviving better than the books themselves, which is a little unusual.
Yeah.
But
yeah, it is a little bit unusual. And I actually really liked the the publisher focused angle. I think that was a good way for me to kind of get into children's literature. Mm-hmm. And then I found more crazy things through that. So I used these bibliographies to verify the titles I already had or that you and Michelle had already added before I was on the project. And I also added more titles from the print bibliographies that weren't in the database yet.
So what was the process of going through those bibliographies? What did you look for? How did you approach it?
So I began with the shortest bibliography, which was John Harris's Books for Youth, which I mm-hmm. think, you know, looking back was probably just a matter of, oh, this looks easy.
Gotta start somewhere.
It had about 300 entries that I had to read through and I look for the presence of a woman in all 300 entries. And I used more sources as well as this first print bibliography to help verify in the case of pseudonyms, first initial only, which happened a couple times mm-hmm. and the like. But I had to kind of comb through the print entries to look for evidence of a woman's involvement, which wasn't always as simple as just looking and seeing that she was the author. It was sometimes kind of a little bit buried. Mm-hmm. So children's books often went through several editions, as I was kind of speaking about earlier. They're a bit ephemeral. Some titles could go up into like the 30s of editions.
It just got
a little bit bananas. Yeah. So the other print bibliographies, I followed that same process. And I used a pencil to circle each entry with a woman's involvement or possible involvement to keep myself going straight. And so I didn't get confused because oftentimes it was buried in the entry.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the SFU copy of John Newbery and His Successors is now quite heavily marked up and the spine has completely cracked from my consultations.
It's funny. It's like I found this with the bibliographies I've worked with. It's like they don't expect people to actually read them. Because as soon as you like go through page by page, the book just falls to pieces.
Yes.
It's like a weird bibliography feature.
I encountered that with the Dartons as well. It's also starting to crack quite severely. And I still have that book lurking around somewhere.
Let's hope nobody at the SFU library is listening to this.
Right. It's not on my account. I don't know. Anyway, so speaking of Newbery and that crazy now broken book. That bibliography, actually, it gave me simultaneously a gem and a thorny problem. For that, I'm speaking of John Newbery's niece-in-law, Elizabeth Newbery. She was a publisher in her own right for 32 years. She published both children's and adult literature. So once I discovered, big air quotes used there, that she was responsible for publishing several of the books in that bibliography, I had to circle each entry with EN listed as a publisher. Bibliographies often use abbreviations to denote basic information like publisher, so it was just EN. As I entered data from the bibliography that had to do with her, alongside entering data where women were authors, but the publisher was another male John Newbery relation, I realized, as I checked this data against the English Short Title Catalog, WorldCat, and a variety of others, that not much was known about Elizabeth Newbery. This, to be a bit cheesy, shook me to my core. Here she was, a woman with several hundred bibliographical entries to her name that she had published, and not even a Wikipedia page for her.
Oh, wow.
And sometimes mistaken as Edward Newbery, who doesn't exist. Yes.
Do you want to say a bit more about the Edward Newbery problem?
Yes. So Michelle found, I think it was the second edition of James Cook's Voyage to the something ocean, many voyages. And it was listed as being published by Edward Newbery, because of course on the title page it says E. Newbery.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle tried to find an actual Edward Newbery, couldn't, asked me to look in the John Newbery bibliography, had nothing about an Edward. So she concluded that someone just made up an Edward Newbery because who else could E. Newbery be? A woman couldn't publish such a title.
Of course not.
Right? So just some crazy things, insertion fantasies. So Elizabeth's story, it's kind of a perfect example of what the WPHP works so tirelessly to remedy, which is women hiding in plain sight or pushed to the margins in favor of a neater male-centric story of lineage and economic prowess.
So you found this female publisher of children's literature and other types of literature. How did you go about making sure all of her titles were entered in the database?
Yeah, that actually was really interesting. It's still not complete, and I know that, because the way that the John Newbery bibliography is structured is the author, Samuel Roscoe, structured it with a part A that was children's literature and a part B that was all other titles. So
helpful.
Yes. I worked my way through the children's literature section. And then when Michelle kind of alerted me that Elizabeth had published Cook's Voyage, I was like, oh no, there's this whole other section that I haven't gone through. So I did go through it a little bit, but it's not finished. She is in there for sure. She did publish adult titles. Actually, I think the split was like pretty equal in terms of her publishing children's versus adults. So that was really interesting.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
Yeah. And
well, and the children's literature alone was a huge job.
Yes, it was a task. But there's definitely still work to be done with Elizabeth Newbery, which is pretty cool.
So you worked through a massive number of titles. But are there any in particular that stood out or any sort of, I guess, subgenres, anything like that? Anything that was unique or unusual or caught your attention that you still remember years later?
Yeah, it was where I was like, what am I going to remember? So there are a couple things that initially stuck out to me. And I'm sure if you ask me this like a week from now, I'll say something different. But for now, the things that came to mind were men. They used women's names as pseudonyms to publish children's literature.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So when I was doing the merge, it was really interesting because a couple times a woman's name would come up, but then there would be a note saying this was actually a man. And I had to kind of get rid of those titles because there was no other, you know, instance of a woman on that title. Yeah. So I was like, well, this is a dude. Huh. It was really interesting to me because often we hear about women writing under men's names to be more credible, et cetera, or for whatever reason. But for this, it was kind of men wanting to look more maternal, more approachable, and kind of have like a marketing thing going where like the whole book was kind of this nice, nurturing, moral like thing that your child could have and you could trust it. It was coming from someone maternal. It was really, really interesting. Yeah, so that was definitely one thing that stood out.
As it does.
Yeah, stood out during the merge. Something that I always tell just random people who would ask me about what I was doing for work, one of the first things I'd say was, did you know Old Mother Hubbard was written by a woman? And they would go, no. It's just one of those like ubiquitous titles that nobody really thinks about. And they'd be like, oh, that, you know, her name's Sarah Catherine Martin. And yeah, definitely a cool thing I found out. One of the cutest things was that the books, they're so tiny. When we were in the British Library, just the physical size of a lot of these children's books, they would fit in the palm of my hand. I took a lot of pictures of books sitting on my hand. So it's interesting because I mentioned before I worked in a bookstore and I've studied publishing. So modernly, I'm aware of like what a children's picture book is supposed to look like in terms of size. And this really surprised me. They're really like pocketbooks, literally. I've even seen some Victorian editions of children's books that fit in a miniature box, really going with the like child-sized theme. And I guess the last thing, this is kind of like an umbrella thing, we mentioned it earlier, just the vast amount of editions that children's literature had. Just because the genre, it really gained ground in the latter half of the 18th and the 19th centuries as ideas about like children and childhood really began to solidify. I saw some titles with higher than 30 editions, more than a few cases where the title page of a certain edition, so let's say the 6th edition, was used over and over again in subsequent print runs. So just the sheer amount of like recycling and the rapid production that went on. Not even to mention the marketing. Mm-hmm. Some of the crazy things that publishers would do. Elizabeth Newbery did this too. She would insert kind of advertisements in the text of the book for other books. This was called puffing. It's kind of like product placement. But so it really was just like marketing feat, this the way that children's literature really grew as a genre and as a publishing stream, I guess you could say.
And I guess that kind of contributes to thinking about how small they were, because larger books were really expensive during the period. So if you had these like little tiny books, people might conceivably be able to buy more of them. So you'd want to make sure that people were...
Yeah, that's very true.
Aware of all the options.
Mm-hmm. It's very true. And quite often, too, what publishers would do is they would release an illustrated book that was not colored, and it would be far cheaper than the colored version. And they'd be the same physical size, but it was interesting because, on the one hand, it was super almost ephemeral, I would say, in like how cheap and mass-produced it was. But then a couple would be like, these are really special. These are really nice.
Yeah, and I remember you talking about finding some books that were actually games. Do you want to talk about those a little bit? Because that's really interesting.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, a lot of the games I found were adaptations of either poems or books.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm not sure if it was the authors themselves thinking about it this way or the publishers, again, just wanting to market more and trying to think of more ways that they could get children involved. It's an adaptation of Catherine Anne Taylor Dorset's poem, The Peacock at Home, which is one of the most successful imitations of William Roscoe's butterfly ball. So this game actually has a lot of things involved. It's got ivory counters, 10 invitation cards, 4 instructional cards, 24 hand-colored picture cards, which each have a bird on them, and a hand-colored decorative sheet. Wow. Yeah, it's very involved. So the game is won by the first player who has all their guests, which are the cards in their hand, invited to the party. So that's the peacock at home. The story is that the peacock is throwing a party. Yeah, and then the cards that are dealt by the dealer have to match to the cards in the player's hands. And so once a player gets rid of all their cards, they win because all of their guests have been invited. Yeah, I was reading about this game, and it's apparently an early example of a game with no clear moral or educational intent.
Oh, interesting.
It's primarily just for fun, although you could make the case that a matching game is definitely educational in some way. Mm-hmm. It's just not as overt as a lot of children's publications could be. my favorite game I encountered, which I thought was just crazy, also has to do with Elizabeth Newbery.
She keeps coming back.
Yes. She... So alongside John Wallace, who was also a publisher, she co-published a game called The New Game of Human Life in 1790. Yes. So the game...
Sounds very modern.
Very modern. It was actually based on a similar French game that had been previously published, and it involves working one's way around an illustrated game board, moving through the phases of life. The game was morally and educationally instructive, beautifully illustrated. It was an innovation at the time for the English market, and Wallace and Newbery, they did really well with it. Yes, as you said, it is very modern. If the name rings a bell, that's because you're right. This is the original version of what we now know simply as Life, which is actually produced by Milton Bradley. The man, Milton Bradley, who was a publisher, he came across the old English game in 1860, and he made his own version, calling it the Checkered Game of Life, which then evolved. Huh. Yes.
Very cool.
He actually said that it paralleled his own life, and he was a little amazed. Yeah. So you can imagine I was simultaneously shocked and really excited that Elizabeth Newbery was co-publisher of, you know, the game Life, yet she was still unknown. I just had to have a moment with that.
Oh. Well, thanks so much, Reese. It was so nice to have you back. We miss you on the project.
Yeah, I miss you guys too. It's always been so much fun. I can't believe I was writing, you know, I started in 2016. It's been 4 years. It's been great to be a part of it.
Glad to have you back in this small capacity.
Yeah.
Very briefly.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah. Thank you so much.
As Reese indicates so well in her interview, another big shout out to Reese for coming on the podcast to chat about this. Educational literature contains a wide range of formats and subgenres, even just among the books actually written for children. Yet despite that diversity, the publication practices surrounding works about education and juvenile literature also demonstrate how publishers specialized in specific areas. So many of the resources Reese used were publisher and or genre specific, whether based on collections held in libraries like the Osborne Collection of Children's Literature, which is held at the University of Toronto Library, or bibliographic lists like Samuel Roscoe's John Newbery and His Successors.
As we've talked about in past episodes, scholarly interest in specific genres has an impact on which titles end up being entered into the WPHP. Certain genres, such as the novel and poetry, have long been the subject of literary scholarship and have often been included in their own bibliographies, which means they're easy for us to find and add as records. Children's literature is another such category, although because it was produced for and handled by children and was often cheaper than other books, there is physically a lot more of it, especially more editions, and less of it survives, which makes it harder for us to be totally comprehensive. So while there is a bibliography for well-known publishers of children's literature like the Newbery family or the Darton family, which means we can be relatively thorough for something like Elizabeth Newbery's publications. There is not a bibliography for a less well-known children's literature publisher like Frances Holston, who, along with her son, published an array of children's books in the early 1800s.
Accounting for educational writing directed at parents presents another set of problems. While it sometimes appears in a work solely dedicated to theorizing and outlining principles for educational practice, as Wollstonecraft's Thoughts on the Education of Daughters does, other titles weave discussions of how to educate children into essays on other topics, or include representations of good parenting in the books written for children. In this episode, we've tried to provide an entertaining and enlightening sample of some of those possibilities. We hope you enjoyed them.
This has been the fourth episode of the WPHP Monthly Mercury. We will be releasing an episode every third Wednesday of the month. If you're interested in learning more about what we discussed today, we've compiled a list of suggestions for further reading and links to some relevant entries in the WPHP in a blog post that you can find at womensprinthistoryproject.com.